members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea. Celebrating the season with Holiday Blend Coffee and Holiday Breakfast Blend Tea at Pete's retail stores or on the web at Pete's.com.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the U.S. Supreme Court affirms Oregon's assisted suicide law.
A report on the first of Mayor Potter's neighborhood meetings.
The town of Amity, Oregon, runs out of water.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,020 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 17th, 2006. I'm Ani Haynes.
And I'm SW Conser. It's Oregon to the rescue for the thousands falling through the cracks of the two-week-old Medicare prescription drug plan. Governor Kulongoski has ordered emergency action for the close to 10,000 Oregonians having trouble getting their prescriptions filled. KBOO's Angela Hancock-Revis reports.
Thousands of Oregonians finding it difficult to get prescriptions filled under the new Medicare plan sent out a 911 alert, and the governor has answered the call. Governor Kulongoski says the state will pay for prescriptions being held up by federal glitches. Jacqueline Zimmer with the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities says these are the kind of problems that have to be expected because the Medicare plan was so rushed.
They refuse to stop and take the time to get it off the ground correctly. It's hurting the state and it's impacting people's day-to-day health.
About 10,000 Oregonians who qualify for both Medicaid and Medicare are caught up in the confusion at pharmacies. Supporters say the plan will help thousands once all the wrinkles have been ironed out. Oregon will pay for a month of medications and hopes the problem will be fixed in 30 days.
The Medicare Modernization Act not only so far has hurt people who need prescription coverage, but it's also hurt the state of Oregon.
Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Angela Hancock-Revis, KBOO News.
Amity school children were sent home at noon today after the district was informed that the city's water supply was low. Amity Police Chief Dan Brown said public works officials discovered this morning that the city's reservoir was extremely low. Meanwhile, Amity's 1,500 wet residents are being asked not to use water unless it's an emergency. Officials said the school district has been told it could take 12 to 24 hours to fix the problem, but that parents should assume a school will begin on time Wednesday unless otherwise notified. About 875 students attend Amity Elementary, Amity Middle, and Amity High Schools. The district is in Yamhill County near McMinnville.
A new report by the City Club of Portland concludes that the Portland Police and Fire Disability and Pension System must be phased out because it is detrimental to the city's financial health, places an unnecessary burden on property taxpayers, and is plagued by accountability problems. The report's release comes a day before the City Council is scheduled to hold a hearing on proposed reforms to the fund. The hearing is at 6 p.m. Wednesday in Council Chambers. The $87 million a year system provides pension and disability payments to about 3,300 active and retired city police and firefighters. It's the only city-operated pay-as-you-go pension and disability system in the country, meaning money for the fund comes straight from Portlanders' property taxes. Each year, the city levies a property tax in an amount equal to the fund's administrative expenses and benefits costs.
Over the weekend, Mayor Tom Potter held the first of a series of neighborhood meetings to hear what's on the minds of Portland's residents. KBOO's Stephanie Potter has more.
Patty's Home Plate Cafe and Deli in the heart of St. John's was host to a community meeting Saturday morning, allowing Portland citizens one-on-one time with Mayor Tom Potter. Residents were given a chance to speak for 10 minutes about issues that were important to them,
with the option of having their comments entered into the city records.
I wanted to meet one-on-one with people in different parts of Portland, so this is really the first of the beginning of my getting out in the community. So it's going to become a regular part where I go out and meet with citizens of different areas. I started with St. John's, but I'm going to be going into Southwest, Outer East Portland, everywhere, and not to go out and talk so much, just to listen to what people have to say, and if there are things that I can respond to, then I will.
That was Mayor Tom Potter, who said he was finding the whole experience very educational.
Well, I've learned a lot. I've learned more issues about PIR, which has races out there and causes a lot of noise in North Portland. Learned about some of the youth programs here in St. John's and how they're beginning to decline. Learned about walkways along the Willamette River that the community would like to see. So it's been a great experience.
The mayor was receiving high marks as participants seemed universally enthusiastic about the process and the mayor's listening skills.
I think it's a great idea. I'm happy to be able to talk one-on-one with the man for a few minutes and have his undivided attention. And he honestly seems to be very interested in what everyone has to say and is planning on working with us.
That was Matt Stein, who was there to discuss his concerns about the size of a building project being considered for the Cathedral Park neighborhood in St. John's. John Mize was there to advocate for extension of the Greenway with a waterfront path from the Steel Bridge to the St. John's Bridge.
Just a great, great thing to be able to sit down with him. And I've often wondered if there would ever be an opportunity to, you know, call the mayor's office and see if you could get an appointment. But here he comes out to the neighborhood. I think it's great.
Jan Woodruff was with a group that advocates turning the Portland International Raceway into an eco park.
It's really a Portland thing. It's a very win-win situation. Not only do we get rid of the noise, but we figured that the economic impact of an eco-park could easily quadruple that of PIR.
She was pleased with the mayor's response.
It was a great experience. He's a very personable guy, and it's so clear that he believes in democracy and that we own the government, not the lobbyists and business interests. You know, certainly they have an important part to play in city politics, but I don't know, for the first time I feel so do we.
Business people as well were on hand to meet with the mayor. Ron Leventon, owner of a men's clothing store, advocated for increased parking. He was with John Baxter, who employs over 400 people in an auto parts business. Baxter spoke to the mayor about reducing business development fees.
He was concerned. I don't know if he can do anything. He knows there's a problem in generating businesses.
Tina Kotek, a candidate for state representative, was happy that the mayor started with St. John's.
This is a part of the city that's been ignored for a long time, so we think it's great he's out here, and people have some very significant issues, and I think it's, whether it's housing or land use issues or trying to do things around our parks, it's really great he's coming here to listen.
Carmen Rubio of the mayor's office helped organize the event and said there was more interest than had been anticipated.
There were people waiting when I got here at 8:15, so I would say by the time he got here, which is just a little bit before 9 o'clock, we had our 10 slots filled. We had to turn away quite a few. Well, we didn't turn them away, but we gave them the locations for the next few. Told them we would definitely be back to St. John's because I think it's clear that there's an interest in on both ends.
Three more meetings are scheduled throughout Portland over the next 3 months. To find out more, you can visit www.portlandonline.com or call the mayor's office. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
Federal officials announced today that steps to boost Oregon coastal coho numbers have been so successful that they do not need to go back on the threatened species list. The decision was a victory for the state of Oregon, which maintains that the fish rebounded with the help of limits on commercial and recreational fishing, reforms in hatchery production, and improvements to habitat. The decision reversed the agency's own proposal 18 months ago to restore threatened species protection to Oregon coastal coho. Oregon coastal coho numbers had plummeted as low as 40,000 in 1998, when they were originally listed as a threatened species. The decision spawned a court case, which resulted in the fish being removed from the list in 2003.
Warming ocean currents are bringing sardines back to Monterey Bay after decades of decline. Some scientists think global warming could be partly responsible for the burgeoning sardine population, although no one can say for sure whether warmer water is part of a natural cycle.
Budget analysts recommend that lawmakers hold off this week on big steps to fill the $168 million hole in the state human services budget. But they also said lawmakers should get ready for a potential special session later. Governor Ted Kulongoski and the legislators' presiding officers are agreed on only one point. No immediate special session of the full legislature will be held. They also say they do not want to slash services or raise taxes to make up the shortfall. With a two-year budget of nearly $10 billion, including federal grants, DHS normally submits a budget rebalancing proposal every 6 months. But because of increasing caseloads and decreasing income from federal and other sources, current spending is outpacing the budget that lawmakers approved last year. Accounting for half of the projected shortfalls is an 8% increase in the number of people who qualify for traditional Medicaid under the Oregon Health Plan. The analysts recommended that by March 1st, agency officials come up with proposals to cut or change services, either by agency or legislative action.
Today was the official launch for the Portland Project Homeless Connect. It's a revolutionary program putting together medical, dental, legal, addiction, and housing counseling services for Portlanders experiencing homelessness. Hundreds of service providers, officials, and volunteers converged on the Oregon Convention Center for the opening. Earlier today, KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Philip Mangano, who's the director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, who was in town for the opening festivities.
Tell us, how is it that this project is unique? What do other city centers do with their homelessness issues?
Sure. Well, first of all, what's important to understand that what is happening today in Portland, that is Project Homeless Connect, which is bringing together a wide array of housing and benefit and employment and health services all under one roof, and then inviting both people from the community and homeless people to gather together to make those resources impact the lives of people who are sleeping out on the streets or sleeping long-term in the shelters. That effort is being replicated in about 30 cities all over our country. So it's an idea that came about in San Francisco and is now spreading, and part of our work in Washington with the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness is to take these good ideas that are showing results, and Project Homeless Connect in cities all across our country have shown the result of moving homeless people off the streets, out of long-term shelter stays, into housing, into health care, into jobs, into better treatment. So what's working in the rest of the country today is working right here in Portland. There are about 300 volunteers here. About 600 homeless people have come to access the services. And it's literally a one-stop where homeless people can come and get legal issues and treatment issues and, again, housing and benefit and employment issues all met under one roof. That is unique for homeless people. And it's will demonstrate that that strategy works in the lives of homeless people. There will be homeless people today who will no longer be homeless. There will be homeless people today who will come in off the streets. There will be homeless people today who will decide to go into treatment. That's a good thing for your streets. It's a good thing for your neighborhoods, and it's an especially good thing for those homeless people.
Sir, I just have to ask you the really hard question about this whole effort. Is it really possible for us to eliminate homelessness? Hasn't homelessness existed since the dawn of time? I mean, what's your big picture on that?
Well, first of all, you may be too young, Lisa. You sound like a young woman. But when I was a young person growing up, we did not talk about homelessness. There was not pervasive homelessness in our country. Certainly there were a few people who might have been drinking a bit too much and out on the street. But for the most part, homelessness was not a big issue in the 1950s, in the 1960s, and even in the early 1970s. So it would not be a remarkable thing for us to get back to the point where homelessness is not a major issue in our country. It is not a pervasive situation. As you may know, here in Portland, I believe on the last count, you had 2,000 people on the streets. Well, you've had periods in Portland's history where there were nowhere near 2,000 people on the streets. So part of our effort is to go back to the common sense and the dollars and cents of reducing and ending homelessness. And we're beginning with the population that's the most vulnerable and the most disabled, and what some costing studies are showing are also the most expensive. People who are randomly ricocheting into the emergency rooms of hospitals, into acute substance abuse and mental health treatment, disproportionate amount of law enforcement and court time is spent with them. Well, Project Homeless Connect and the mayor's 10-year plan are directed specifically at that population to end their homelessness. That's the first stage in the effort to end all of homelessness. So can we end chronic homelessness? Can we end the homelessness of those who are the most vulnerable, most disabled? Well, what we're seeing in city after city across the country that have developed 10-year plans, that are implementing Project Homeless Connect and implementing a housing strategy, we're seeing fewer people on the streets of San Francisco, fewer people on the streets of Philadelphia and Miami and other cities. So absolutely, we have the capacity to get the job done.
We have been speaking with Phil Mangano. He's the director of the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, visiting Portland for the special launch of a special project by the City Council and various city agencies called Portland Homeless Connect.
And that was KBOO's very own Lisa Loving. For more information on Project Homeless Connect, you can go to www.portlandhomelessconnect.com.
In a 6-3 vote today, the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed the Bush administration's attempt to use a drug law to prosecute doctors who prescribe overdoses. To get a local perspective and to explore possible implications of this decision, KBOO's Jim Thompson talks to a local activist and expert on the subject.
I'm speaking with Robert Kenneth from the Death with Dignity National Center. We just heard the big news of the day regarding Death with Dignity and the Supreme Court decision. Robert, can you tell us, what does this really mean?
Well, the victory is for the people of Oregon who voted twice to preserve an individual's right to determine their own end-of-life care. It's also a victory for terminally ill patients around the country, not only with regards to end-of-life care, but also for pain management and palliative care.
The Bush administration has come out in opposition to this before the decision. And after the decision, I think Scott McClellan indicated that the administration was very disappointed. Do you have a response to that?
I couldn't be more happy and more pleased that Scott is disappointed and that the Bush administration is disappointed. Conservative judicial activism is now obvious. It's there for everyone to see. This case is about everything that conservatives say that they believe in with regards to government, states' rights, local governance, individualism, and democratically passed laws. The hypocrisy has been astounding with regards to John Ashcroft's personal crusade and Alberto Gonzalez's personal crusade to overturn this Oregon law. It couldn't be more obvious the hypocrisy with which the Bush administration has pursued this very democratically passed law that basically says, as always, the states have the authority to determine and determine legitimate medical practice. And for them to turn around and say that they wanted to overturn the Oregon law is hypocrisy.
In the Supreme Court decision, I believe it was 6-3, with Scalia and Roberts dissenting.
And Clarence Thomas.
That is essentially the right wing.
Well, and it's really quite disappointing with regards to John Roberts, because statements he's made in the past with regards to state authority over legitimate medical practices led us to believe that if he were a true conservative in the traditional sense, a small c conservative, that he would definitely have voted to support Oregon's Death with Dignity Act. If politics and kind of a neocon agenda come into it, then obviously, you know, one could conjecture that that's what was guiding his vote today.
I'd like to change the subject. While I have you on the phone, perhaps you could give us some of the background behind assisted suicide and your organization. When did it start?
The Death with Dignity National Center came together in 1994 with the Oregon Death with Dignity organization to write a very specific law that allowed terminally ill patients to receive a medical prescription to hasten their end of life. The law was passed by the people of Oregon 51-49 in 1994, and was immediately sent into the courts. It was opposed vehemently by various religious groups and arch-conservative groups. Opponents of the law in the Oregon legislature tried to overturn the law with ballot measure 51. Oregonians voted against ballot measure 51 in 1997, 60% to 40%, basically telling the legislature to back off and mind their own business. Oregonians voted for this law twice now. The Death with Dignity National Center has brought this case through the federal courts all the way to the Supreme Court and has won. And today we are working with a number of states that have shown an interest in replicating this law.
Do you have any closing thoughts, anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to say?
Well, if there's an effort in Congress to pass some kind of an anti-physician-assisted dying law, the Death with Dignity National Center will meet that challenge face-to-face.
Thank you so much. And I have one more thing to say, which is KBOO News, this is Jim Thompson.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
After this interview was recorded, KBOO learned from the Associated Press that Oregon lawmakers expect the Supreme Court ruling to be challenged in Congress. Senator Ron Wyden says he believes this could be a hot-button issue with the elections coming up.
A Linwood animal rescue organization is caring for dozens of beached western grebes. That's a kind of seabird, not used to spending much time on land. The Progressive Animal Welfare Society says the birds are suffering from exhaustion, dehydration, lack of food, and injuries after recent rough winter storms in the area. Officials say they found the birds near ocean beaches, close to death, with their wings full of sand. At the rescue center, the birds are put in small pools to clean them up, and then the feathers are dried using special blow dryers. Not all seabirds on beaches need help, so people are asked to call wildlife officials before attempting a rescue on their own.
The current time is 5:22. Coming up next is headlines from around the world, followed by the best of free speech radio news, and independent native news follows that at the usual time of 5:55. At 6 o'clock this evening, hear This Way Out, and at 7, hear Clemmy's Grooves. Tonight's weather, showers, and lots of them. Lows 35 to around 40. Southwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, showers again, with highs 45 to 50. South wind 10 to 20 miles per hour. You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO, in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
After falling well short of its recruiting goals last year, the Army has set even higher monthly targets for this summer, hoping that new financial incentives will attract high school and college graduates in the face of mounting deaths in Iraq. From June to September, the Army will try to recruit between 8,600 and 10,400 soldiers per month, well above the numbers achieved last year. To reach those goals, recruiters will be armed with more than catchy slogans and national pride. A new law will allow the Army to give larger financial bonuses for enlistments and reenlistments, doubling the maximum payment to new active duty recruits from $20,000 to $40,000 and from $10,000 to $20,000 for its reservists. It will also let older recruits sign on by raising the top age from 35 to 42. And the top reenlistment bonus for active duty soldiers will increase from $60,000 to $90,000. The Army has also increased the percentage of recruits it will accept that fall below certain aptitude levels. Now, 4% of the annual recruits can score at the lowest acceptable level compared with 2%. The Defense Department has set 4% as the maximum amount, but the individual military services can set lower limits.
And a National Guard program that offers up to $2,050 to people who bring in new soldiers is now open to the public. The program, called the Guard Recruitment Assist Program, or GRAP for short, offers participants $50 for completing an online training session to become recruiting assistants, $1,000 for bringing in a new soldier, and another $1,000 if that recruit goes to basic training. At the start of the program, only Guard members could register to be RAs. Now the contractor, DocuPack, Inc., is working to hire veterans, retirees, spouses, and other community members. Guard leaders project the program will bring in 7,000 to 11,000 recruits in its first year.
Under a court settlement, a rural California school district says it won't ever offer a course that promotes or endorses creationism, creation science, or intelligent design. The school district today agreed to stop a Fraser Mountain High School class next week. The philosophy class taught a religion-based alternative to evolution. Its original syllabus said the class would discuss the scientific, biological, and biblical aspects that suggest why Darwin's philosophy is not rock solid. The teacher, who is the wife of a minister, recently wrote that it was the class that the Lord wanted her to teach. A group of parents sued with the help of Americans United for the separation of church and state. A lawyer at that group says the deal sends a strong signal that schools can't promote creationism or intelligent design.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 17th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org.
You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM. On transmitter K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Jim Thompson. Excuse me. Tonight's audio editor is Kate Welch. Special thanks to reporters Stephanie Potter and Jim Thompson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving, and tonight's broadcast was engineered by Judy Feistel. I'm Ani Haynes.
And I'm S.W. Conser. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News and Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News at 7:30 a.m. Hear Talk Radio, and that's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Barbara Bernstein tomorrow morning at 7:30 a.m. will host a special Whole Communities radio project on how cultural development fosters healthy, sustainable communities and inspires neighborhood walking. Guests include community arts consultant Bill Bulick and public concert producer Kristen Knapp. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller features updates related to some recent programs as well as other news. At 10:30, Per Fagering interviews Richard Heinberg, who has been writing about energy resource issues and the dynamics of cultural change for many years. His new book is Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! Here on your community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, January 17, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, the Senate Judiciary Committee postpones Samuel Alito's confirmation vote for 1 week. The King of Nepal places an additional indefinite ban on opposition rallies and meetings. And we'll go to Harlem, where healthcare workers are demanding a living wage. We'll bring you these stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit today against the National Security Agency, charging that the agency's domestic spying operation violates several key tenets of American democracy. Quinn Bowman reports from Washington, D.C.
The ACLU today filed a lawsuit in federal court in Detroit that challenges the legality and constitutionality of the National Security Agency's domestic spying program. The Bush administration says the program is limited to gathering crucial information on terror suspects who communicate with American citizens. The ACLU filed the lawsuit on behalf of itself, various nonprofit groups, and several journalists and academics. It charges that the NSA program violates the First and Fourth Amendment of the Constitution and the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. ACLU Executive Director Anthony Romero says the program represents an unprecedented power grab by the executive branch and predicts the lawsuit will have serious implications.
We do believe that this lawsuit goes squarely at issues of our democracy and the rule of law. We do expect, given the salience of this issue, that this would be a case that would end up before the Supreme Court.
James Bamford, an expert on the NSA and client in the lawsuit, said that this covert program, which is still in operation, mines vast amounts of data from an ever-growing web of individuals, many of whom have nothing to do with terror suspects. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Quinn Bowman in Washington, D.C.
The targeted assassination of a Hamas leader in the West Bank today could add to the climate of tension in the run-up to the January 25th elections. Manar Jabreen reports from the West Bank.
Israeli soldiers today assassinated Thabit Ayada, a 24-year-old leader of Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas. The assassination occurred during an Israeli invasion of the West Bank city of Tul Kerem. An exchange of gunfire was reported prior to Ayada's death. A similar assassination of an Islamic Jihad leader in Tul Kerem sparked a cycle of violence in the region that took weeks to calm. Hamas has vowed revenge for the killing of one of its leaders. The violence comes as Palestinians in the occupied territories and Jerusalem are busy with political campaigns in preparation for the January 25th Legislative Assembly elections. Hamas is favored to win elections in a number of West Bank cities and towns. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibreen.
Protests against the presence of United Nations peacekeepers erupted in Ivory Coast today. The West African nation has been divided since 2002 between rebels in the north and the government in the south. Supporters of President Laurent Gbagbo demonstrated in towns throughout the south after international mediators appointed by the UN called on Parliament to step down. The demonstrators laid siege to the UN compound in the Ivorian capital. UN troops responded using tear gas and firing warning shots. Reuters reports in the town of Daloa, UN vehicles have been attacked and homes of UN workers have been looted. The UN peacekeeping mission is to oversee the peace process and provide stability during the elections scheduled for later this year. A severe drought continues to bake countries in East Africa. After months of alerts, the World Food Program now estimates 5.4 million people in the Horn of Africa are in urgent need of emergency food aid. Pastoral and agropastoral communities have been particularly hard hit as livestock numbers have dwindled for lack of water and grazing land. In drought-stricken areas of Kenya, over 30 people have reportedly died from starvation-related diseases in the past 2 months. The drought comes after two consecutive failed rainy seasons, and the next rainy season is months away. The foreign secretaries of India and Pakistan met in New Delhi today to begin a fresh round of bilateral talks. The two countries are expected to discuss progress on the two-year-old peace process. Shahnawaz Khan has more.
This is the third round of talks in so-called composite dialogue process between India and Pakistan since a peace process began 2 years ago. Analysts say this round comes at a delicate time as the two sides accuse each other of stalling the process. India blames Pakistan for aiding terrorism in India, while Pakistan says India is not making any headway on the Kashmir issue. On the first day of talks, Indian Foreign Secretary Shyam Saran raised India's concerns over terrorism, while his Pakistani counterpart Riaz Mohammed raised the issue of India commenting on the unrest in Pakistan's Balochistan region. The two sides today also reviewed the progress on the peace process and other confidence-building measures. After the success of Trans-Kashmir bus service that was launched last year, the two sides have decided to launch two more bus services and rail links connecting cities in the two countries. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate Judiciary Committee vote scheduled for today on Judge Samuel Alito's confirmation to the Supreme Court has been postponed until next week. Although Democrats on the committee called for the delay, it doesn't appear the Democratic caucus is united enough to stall the Alito nomination with a filibuster. Nevertheless, numerous advocacy and civil rights groups are calling for such a parliamentary move to stop Alito from replacing Sandra Day O'Connor on the bench. Washington editor Mitch Jezerich spoke to some of those groups about their views on the Democrats and the confirmation process.
They say death row!
We say hello!
They say death row!
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger denied Allen a clemency hearing on Friday, while state and federal courts rejected last-ditch appeals. Allen's attorneys argued that executing an old man would be cruel and unusual punishment. Allen, who turned 76 years old yesterday, became the oldest man executed in the state and second oldest in the U.S. The native Choctaw Indian was legally blind, used a wheelchair, and had to be carried by guards the last few feet to the execution chamber. Allen suffered a major heart attack last September and nearly died.
This is an abomination, this execution.
Mike Farrell, former star of TV's MASH, is executive director of Death Penalty Focus.
This is a man who can do no one any harm, who is alive today because prison medical authorities saved him from a serious heart attack that would have killed him, only to have the pleasure in somebody's mind of killing him themselves.
While serving a life sentence at Folsom Prison for murder, Allen was convicted and sentenced to die in 1982 for ordering the murders of three individuals who testified against him in the earlier trial.
Byron Shetwitz, Douglas White, Josephine Rocha.
The victims' names were read aloud by a member of Pax Christi, a nonprofit Catholic peace movement which opposes capital punishment. Billy Hamilton, the man who actually committed the murders, also landed on death row, but no execution date has been set. As a private investigator for 26 years, Melody Ermachild works to defend people sentenced to death. As applied in the U.S., she says, capital punishment is arbitrary and capricious, and the system cannot be fixed.
I could let you look at every case file I have. Hundreds and hundreds of them, and you could never separate them into the ones that got death or didn't get death, or even the ones you thought deserved death and the ones you thought didn't deserve death. It can't be done because it is literally the luck of the draw. It really is like a lottery. And because of the racism in this country and the poverty situation in this country, it falls on the people who don't have the resources.
Claire Clarence Ray Allen's granddaughter, Paula, thanked the crowd for their support, but says her grandpa is ready to move on.
My grandpa, he said now, finally, you know, he's going to be off death row and his spirit's going to be free, you know.
Lee Polanco is a spiritual advisor to Native American inmates at San Quentin and other prisons around California.
It's wrong to kill people. It doesn't matter if it comes from an airplane. It doesn't matter if it comes with a bullet. And it doesn't matter if it comes with a needle. It's wrong.
Some death penalty opponents support life in prison without parole, while still others ally themselves with abolitionist movements. Dorsey Nunn is with a national organizing initiative for ex-prisoners called All of Us or None.
Because we lost another one tonight, it means that we still have a responsibility to organize and do something fruitful with the time that we have left here.
Three more executions are set this year in California. Michael Morales is scheduled to die next month unless the California moratorium on executions is passed. The legislation, known as Assembly Bill 1121, would place a 2-year hold on executions while a study is done to ascertain how much the process has failed, ending in wrongful conviction and executions of the innocent. With help from Sarah Olson, I'm Vinny Lombardo for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate Judiciary Committee was scheduled to vote today on the confirmation of Judge Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court, but committee Democrats used their one-time option to postpone the vote until next Tuesday, in a move that is likely meant to build opposition to the nominee. Still, it doesn't appear that Democrats are looking to filibuster. Democratic Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, the only woman on the Judiciary Committee, told the Sunday morning talk show Face the Nation on CBS that she'll vote against Alito's confirmation. But she also said she doesn't think a filibuster is merited.
This is a man I might disagree with. That doesn't mean he shouldn't be on the court. He's clearly qualified. I was very impressed with his ability to maintain a very even demeanor during this entire thing.
The Democrats do have enough votes to block.
Ellie Smill is the president of the Feminist Majority Foundation. The foundation is calling on Democrats to filibuster the Alito confirmation.
I think the right thing to do is to stop the appointment. But I do think that many people would be disappointed, especially most of the constituency groups. Every major constituency group, be it African Americans, Hispanics, women, labor, workers, who are concerned about workers' rights. Remember, this is a vote that would narrow the interpretation of the Commerce Clause, so it doesn't cover many workers, for example, in state and local government for the Family Medical Leave Act. It would put many workers' protections in jeopardy. So it's a vote against environmental protection. So all the environmental groups have come out against them. The disability groups have come out against them. So it's the core, really, of the Democratic base. So they're going to be very disappointed. That's why I think and I hope the Democrats put up a major fight.
Of course, the core of the Republican base, at least the right-wing religious core of it, was able to derail Harriet Myers. Do you think that...
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that they took Harriet Myers off. The right wing said no, she wasn't right-wing enough, although she's a very, essentially Bush vote. And they put on even a more extreme right-wing vote. And in case you're wondering where Roberts is, if people are, Roberts just voted with Scalia and Thomas against the Oregon suicide vote. You know, we've always said he was right-wing. You put out another one, you're just jeopardizing the court. And this one is viewed to be even further to the right than Roberts. So this is the time to fight. And certainly, when all the base of the Democratic Party groups are saying, fight, I don't think they should be ignored.
David Halpern is the director of Campus Progress, the youth outreach program with the Center for American Progress. The group is also looking to Democrats to filibuster the Alito nomination.
He wasn't willing to commit to Roe versus Wade as precedent particularly or as settled law. He took a number of stands that did reveal that he is quite a conservative judge. So in the face of that, it just means that we have a very conservative, a very effective conservative elected majority. And although I believe we have a progressive majority in the country, there isn't enough energy, creativity right now, it looks like, to rally those people. And there isn't the case hasn't been made strongly enough as to something that I believe is truly the case, which is that the Supreme Court matters, no matter who you are, to your daily lives.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote on the nomination of Judge Alito next Tuesday. If passed, the nomination will then go to the Senate floor later in the week. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Australia's Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme, or PBS, was created by constitutional referendum when Australians went to the polls in 1948 and voted for the plan. The PBS is subsidized by the Australian government, and pharmaceuticals listed under the scheme are made accessible and affordable for all Australians. But now, the PBS has come under attack by the United States through its free trade agreement with Australia, and the newly formed Medicines Working Group met in Washington last week to discuss details of the agreement, which have not been made public and are subject to much speculation. Cinnamon Napard has more from Sydney.
Through the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme, or PBS, all Australians have access to affordable medication. But this scheme has come under attack by major US drug manufacturers who see the PBS as a threat to their market share and substantial profits. Professor Peter Drahosh from the Regulatory Institutions Network at the Australian National University, or ANU, is concerned that public health has been put on the negotiating table.
I think the critical thing here is that for the first time, the PBS is a matter of negotiation as part of a trading relationship with the world's most powerful trading relationship. Historically speaking, Australia has been the architect of the PBS. What shape the PBS will take, it's been in a position to decide how much money to spend and so on. Now, a lot of these things will in the future have to be negotiated with the United States. And the interests of the United States are very different to the interests of Australian citizens and the interest that Australians have in healthcare outcomes. I mean, we basically want access to a large variety of medicines at an affordable price, whereas the interest of the United States in a trading context is driven by the pharmaceutical industry. And they want to maximize the revenue they get from their drugs. And so there's a fundamental tension between that trading interest that the United States has and the social interests that Australians have in getting access to a wide range of medicines at an affordable price.
Peter Drahosh from ANU is very critical of the motivation behind the United States free trade agreements.
Basically, the only reason that the United States is negotiating free trade agreements is in order to secure better outcomes on intellectual property. I mean, the main thing that the United States has to sell to the rest of the world are intellectual property rights, and much of that is actually driven by biotechnology and by pharmaceuticals. So it's utterly naive to think that the PBS won't come under the close and critical scrutiny of the US pharmaceutical industry.
Acting Prime Minister and Trade Minister Mark Vail, on the one hand, says that the PBS is safe and will not be affected by the free trade deal, while on the other hand, he says that provisions in the deal will come under discussion. In 2004, the then opposition leader Mark Latham introduced an amendment to prevent so-called evergreening, where drug companies can extend the life of a patent by making small changes to the drug and patenting those changes. The side effect of this is that generic drugs never make it onto the shelves and the price of the original drug remains high. Paul Chamberlain, spokesperson for Medicines Australia, says that this amendment wasn't really necessary and if removed would not adversely affect the PBS.
All it does is effectively outlaw something that couldn't happen in Australia and has never happened in Australia, which is this idea of evergreening or patent protection. But the side effect of it is that he actually stymies investment or possible investment here in Australia.
But Dr. Thomas Faunce, senior lecturer in law and medicine at the Australian National University, disagrees.
How can you possibly say that amendments designed to stop evergreening are going to have an adverse effect on industry? It's a practice that they shouldn't be engaging in, a practice that involves them in all sorts of litigation. And here they say that essentially by removing this, we should somehow condone evergreening, which is the spurious and fake use of intellectual property law to prolong monopoly rents over patents.
Paul Chamberlain, spokesperson for Medicines Australia, believes that overturning this amendment would not affect the PBS at all. But if that's the case, why is the United States so keen to do so? Dr. Thomas Faunce from the Australian National University has a couple of theories.
One is that the United States pharmaceutical industry has a sort of broader long-term agenda on how it wants to drive evergreening around the world, and it doesn't want to set the precedent that some small country like Australia can stand up to it and create a contrary precedent. In other words, it's the sort of thing where, you know, you've got to win at all costs and you can't afford to have anybody be seen to be standing up to the United States. And the other argument is possibly that it's just a smokescreen for the real agenda, which is to drive major privatization, what they would call reforms, but we would call destructions of adequate healthcare, into the heart of the Australian system, basically making the Australian system more like the ridiculous healthcare system that currently operates in the United States.
Whatever the case, it seems the Australian government is being squeezed from both sides, and only time will tell as to where its priorities lie. While the very players who are calling for more transparency in the pharmaceutical benefit scheme meet behind closed doors in Washington. For Free Speech Radio News in Sydney, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
In commemoration of the life and struggles of slain civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., politicians from across New York State's political landscape came out in solidarity with home health care workers who held a rally in Harlem to demand a living wage. From the Big Apple, Ian Forrest has the story.
In the bitterly cold temperatures that prevailed in New York City yesterday, Gladys Minardi, a veteran home health care worker from Haiti, was clear why after 21 years in her profession, she had taken to the streets rallying with her union on Martin Luther King Day.
I'm supposed to have 40-hour job, and then sometime they give me replacement in the afternoon, and then I have no money to pay my bills. I have a lot of trouble. That's why I need somebody. I need help. I need to give me my 40-hour job to do something.
Judging from all the politicians who addressed the rally in solidarity with her and her peers, help could well be on the way. Newly elected Speaker of the New York City Council, Christine Quinn, speaking with a host of City Council members flanking her, promised the continued commitment of City Hall in seeing a wrong made right.
If Dr. King was here, he would say it as loudly as it could that it is wrong that government gives these companies $16 an hour, and many of you get less than $7 an hour. Where is the rest of that money going?
Leading the way in what could either be viewed as a timely and appropriate move or sheer political gamesmanship, Nassau County Executive Thomas Swasey, who is expected soon to announce his candidacy for the New York State governorship race, came to the platform and signed a ceremonial copy of the living wage bill for Nassau County, which would see people working as contractors there earning $9.50 an hour in 2007, much more than the proposed statewide minimum of $7. For the same period.
If you're willing to go to work every day, if you're willing to take care of our parents and our grandparents, if you're willing to get up and take the early bus, we think you deserve a living wage.
Elliot Spitzer, the current state attorney general, who is also making a run for the governorship, wanted to clearly establish in the minds of those in attendance that despite all his successes in fighting corporate corruption and environmental infractions, no fight was as important to him as the one particularly for the immigrant working man and woman of the state.
My pledge to you, when I am fortunate enough to become governor, we will get a decent wage for every man and woman in this state. We will do it because it is just and it is right.
While encouraged by the presence of the star-studded cast of politicians who took to the platform, Union Vice President Keith Josephs of SEIU 1199, organizer of the rally, hopes to see them taking their professed support for the right to a living wage by the home health care workers of New York to the next level, actually putting in place legislation that would make accountable the agencies to which these home health care workers are employed. For FSRN in New York, I am Ian Forrest.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Our technical production team includes Jade Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. FSRN will be holding our annual meeting by telephone conference tonight, January 17, and we invite you to attend and comment. For information on how you can participate, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. You can also send an email to comments@fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Abogado.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, January 17, 2006. I'm Robert Hannon in for Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The scandal involving Washington, D.C. lobbyist Jack Abramoff resulted in an unusual gathering between two California tribes and members of the San Diego County Jewish community. Ellen Cherchak reports.
Some Jewish members of the Southern California community invited tribes to meet with them after Abramoff pleaded guilty to defrauding four Indian tribes. One Jewish anthropology professor feared Abramoff's actions might stir up hostility between tribes and Jews in San Diego County. One thing that seems certain is that Abramoff's actions won't keep tribes out of the political scene, where they have now become powerful players. Maurice Lyons is tribal chairman for the Morongo Band.
We employ a lobbyist in Sacramento and in Washington, D.C. We do our voter registration. We do the whole full gamut.
Members of the Morongo Band and the Torres Martinez Band eventually ended up meeting with a rabbi, two law professors, two Holocaust survivors, and a leading casino consultant at a Palm Desert synagogue for a discussion. One other tribe pulled out because it had used Abramoff's services. Organizers say they'd like to continue with future interactions and a website for Native American Jewish dialogue. I'm Ellen Cherchak in Sacramento.
A bill that would give the Wisconsin legislature the power to approve or reject new tribal off-reservation casinos got a hearing in the state capitol last Wednesday. Supporters say it would give voters a voice in regulating the expansion of tribal gaming. Gil Halstead reports.
Opposing the bill are tribes who have applied to the federal government to open new off-reservation casinos and local communities who hope those casinos will provide new jobs and tax revenues. Menominee Tribal Chairman Michael Chapman says there's already enough local oversight of new casino proposals, and allowing legislators a role would complicate an already cumbersome process.
There's probably a good 10 to 12 public hearings on every sequence of the application and intergovernmental agreements, environmental impact statements, and we're abiding by that. Now to throw 132 legislators into the mix is sort of ridiculous.
But legislatures in five other states already have veto power over new tribal casinos. State Senator Glenn Grothman says Wisconsin should join that list. He says casinos have an impact on the entire state economy, and opponents of the bill who testified at the hearing represent only a small number of people who would benefit.
It's not surprising that these people would show up looking for a bunch of money at the expense of the rest of the state, but it's up for the legislature to look for everybody, not just the few thousand people who are a member of Indian tribes of the state or the couple of communities that are looking for new casinos.
But opponents of the bill fear it could lead to casino money playing a larger role in influencing legislative elections. Casino-rich tribes have already contributed large sums to the governor's campaign, and if legislators gain veto power over new gaming halls, they could also become susceptible to influence peddling. Governor Jim Doyle is opposed to letting the legislature play a role in tribal gaming decisions, but he's not said whether he would veto this bill. It passed the state assembly in September. Supporters expect the state Senate to take it up soon. Gil Halstead, Madison, Wisconsin.
The Oneida Indian Nation's application to put almost 18,000 acres into a federal trust has some local government officials in central New York worried. WSHU's Ebong Udama reports.
The Oneida own the Turning Stone Casino and Resort, located west of Utica, New York. They'd like the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs to put the land into trust. But local government officials in the area are concerned this would cause too many problems. They argue that such a move would exempt the land from local and state taxes and laws. The BIA has held local hearings to consider the environmental and economic effects of putting the land into trust. Oneida Indian Nation CEO Ray Halberder says the tribe's 4,500 casino employees pay enough already in property, school, income, and sales taxes to make up for any other taxes. He says the nation is being unfairly blamed for local problems. In Fairfield, Connecticut, I'm Ebong Udama.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Robert Hannon.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.